We are on Easter Sunday, and I've tied Easter in with the series we're going to do for the month of April, and the series is called Anything, and I will unpack that a little bit more as we get going, but it's Easter Sunday. It is the Sunday where we celebrate that the cross wasn't the end of the story, where Jesus was laid in the tomb, but it doesn't mean that it was done, that he was done changing lives, done changing the course of history. But we come Easter Sunday and we celebrate the fact that not even death could hold him down. This morning I want to start off with a story. Now, I've often told stories about my time at Bible school, and I've shared about one of my mentors I had while I was at Bible school, and how he challenged me and how he'd ask tough questions. And for the sake of animosity, we'll call him Ed. It's not his name. And if you've ever had anything to do with Briarcrest or spent any time there, you know exactly who I'm talking about when I tell this story. So I'm not really hiding him. And he's not really a story he would be ashamed of. We'll call him Ed for the course. And Ed had been at Briarcrest for a very, very, very long time. And Ed was this personality that he would do anything to have impact in the lives of the guys that he was invested in. He oversaw one of the largest dorms at Briarcrest, oversaw three levels of guys, as you can imagine. He was very white and gray-haired very quickly doing that. But he had been there so long, and his personality was such that there were stories about him. Stories that were so far-fetched, so grandiose, that they almost started to get like legend, right? And he didn't know what was fact, what was truth, and what had been elaborated over the course of time as people told and retold the story. And so this morning I'm going to share one of those stories with you. This happened before my time, so I'm hearing it second hand, third hand. I can't remember how many hands it had gone down before it got to me. But one year, Ed had a student in one of his dorms that was particularly difficult. Now, Ed loved his students, and the last thing he'd ever want to do is have a student thrown out of school, but that was always an option. If you weren't going to follow the rules, if you weren't maintaining your academic level, if you met these certain criteria, the reality is that your time at school could be ended. And this particular student, they had tried everything. They'd given him work demerits, they'd given him taken away privileges, taken away car keys, taken away, and they had tried everything under the sun to get this guy corrected, but it just seemed like he just wanted out. And he was willing to do whatever it took to get out, but he wasn't going to leave. He was going to be asked to leave, because that's the proper way to do it. But Ed didn't want him to. Ed knew that Jesus had a big plan for him. Jesus wanted to do something amazing through him at school. And so he went and he asked the question that we so often need to ask in our life and so often forget to ask it. He said, "What would Jesus do? I've tried everything. God, you need to." And he thought about it, and he had an idea. So one day he calls a student in, and he lays it all out for this young man. He says, "We have tried everything for you. We've disciplined you. We've taken away rights. And the reality is that if you do not clean up your act, if you do not turn things around, your time at school is coming to an end." And Ed said, "I think I have an idea." And he leaned back in his desk, opened a drawer, pulled out a hammer, much like this one. And he said, "Punishing you doesn't seem to be working, so what if you punished me instead?" He flipped the hammer around, handed it to the young student, put his hand on the desk and said, "I want you to start hitting fingers until you decide to stop misbehaving." And the young man, as bad and as rebellious as he was, didn't think this was a very good idea. So obviously he said no. First the hammer came out and he was worried that Ed had a plan. But when he offered to have his own fingers smashed in his place. The young man said, yeah, no, I don't think that's a very good idea. He's like, Ed said, are you sure? The young man said, yeah, I'm sure. So he handed the hammer back to Ed, thinking that the story was done, thinking that this was all that was going to happen. And much to the student's shock, he took the hammer, he gave it a flip, broke his own thumb. And he lifted it up again. He said, which finger do I hit next? At this point, the young man is in tears, shocked that Ed would do this to himself. And said, I'm done. I give up. I give in. If you're willing to smash your thumb over this, then I'll stop. I'll give it. And the young man left the office in tears. The whole dorm heard the slam of the hammer and was sure that Ed had hit something, but not his own hand. And obviously Ed went to the hospital, got cleaned up, and the rest is history. The young man turned around. He actually ended up becoming quite influential in the school for all the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. So obviously it worked, but the question is, which brings me to my first question this morning. Is it true? Or do you think some of the details have been exaggerated a bit? Everyone online, I'll ask a couple more questions throughout the course of the service, but you share in Facebook or on YouTube. You guys, what do you think? How many people think that that is exactly how the story played out? Hands up if you think that's a true story. Oh, how many people think it's a tall tale? It got stretched a little bit. Most people aren't putting their hand up. There's a couple of them are like, yeah, that doesn't, yeah. Nobody's willing to think that it's true. That's fair. I will say this. Obviously, the way that this story goes really good is that I was the student. I wasn't. This happened way before my time. So I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. I didn't talk to the students who had seen it. I didn't talk to the guy who was sitting in the office when Ed smashed his own thumb. And I really wish I could say that when I remember Ed, I remember that his thumb didn't quite work. Like, I wish I could say that. And I don't remember whether or not he did. But what I can tell you is that I know Ed. And I know how radically he loved his boys. They were always his boys. They're always his sons. They weren't just kids that showed up. They weren't just a bunch of wild. And to give you an idea, the dorm that this young man was on was called the Zoo. Okay? So like it was a wild bunch. But he loved every one of those boys. He literally would have done anything to see Jesus move. He literally would have done anything to see them stick around at school. He'd never want to see anyone leave. And over the course of the years at my time, 3 years I spent with Ed. One under his direct mentorship, two working alongside him as I worked in the high school dorm. And I remember sitting in his office, late at night, he'd gone home, and as all young men do, you go through the drawers when you're sitting at a desk, right? Oh, let's see, Ed hiding anything good in here? And every time, you open the top right drawer of the desk, there was a hammer. And it sure looked like it had been used for something other than nails. And it never left. It was always a reminder. When we come to the story of the resurrection, when we talk about Jesus and Good Friday and the Easter weekend, very few people question that Jesus died. In fact, very few people even question the method of which he died. We've gotten to the point where history confirms that Jesus was a real person. He really did walk. He really did encounter others. He really did influence thousands of people. He really did stir up Jerusalem. We have so many outside sources other than the Bible that confirm that he walked, confirm his impact on the day. And we have so many sources that confirm that, yes, in fact, he was crucified. And the details that the gospel writers write. I was reading an article in prep for Good Friday from a doctor And the doctor was reading through the account as given by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and he was so astounded at the details that these uneducated men recorded around Jesus' crucifixion. In fact, the details that these guys were recording made it more real for him from a medical perspective, just confirming that, yeah, this really did happen. There's no question that this happened. But when we talk about the resurrection, see, people don't come back from the dead. People typically stay dead. You know, and over the course of history, everybody follows that model except for this one guy. Well, that's not true. Jesus brought people back from the dead. The prophets brought people back from the dead. So people did return, but nobody ever actually brought themselves back from the dead the way that Jesus did. The one person who actually overcame the odds. And so when we read the story, and we're in Matthew 27 as we read the story this morning, there's questions, there's doubt, is this really happening? Matthew 28, sorry, we're going to be in Matthew 28. If you have your paper Bible, a little setup before the preamble. So Jesus is taken off the cross, he's buried in the tomb, and the chief priests are concerned that the disciples are going to steal the body and say, see, look, he said he was going to come back, his body's gone. He's come back. He is resurrected. He's alive. Woo! And so the chief priests have a plan. They take a big rock and put it in front of the tomb. They seal the tomb. And what the seal was a little added extra protection, but it was also a Roman seal to say that Roman guards signed off on the fact that indeed this rock was here. And if the rock moved, it would break the seal. And there's Roman guard, a group of soldiers standing guard in front of the door, making sure that the disciples didn't try anything funny. Now remember, we're talking about fishermen taking on trained soldiers, so good chance this wasn't going to happen. Matthew 28, verse 1. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men, Roman soldiers, scared of this man. And the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen. As he said, come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with great fear and joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. I'm sure they really wanted to hear this. And when they had assembled all the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were sleeping. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed, and this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Now, a couple of little things about the guards. A, if their captain found out they fell asleep, they're dead. Matthew intentionally records that only some of the guard went back. And the rest of them took off. They're like, "We're dead. This is bad. We're out of here." The other ones came in because they're so blown away. They got to tell the chief priest what has happened. They're basically trying to plead their life, saying, "I know what we were supposed to do. We didn't do it. The body's gone. Oops." So the chief priests pay them off, saying, no, that's not what you tell them. You tell people that the disciples came while you were sleeping. And if the governor hears it, we'll make sure that you don't die. Because this was a death penalty for the Romans. They had a job and they failed. And it wasn't like, next time. No, you're dead. You were paid to do something. You sealed the rock. And imagine the amount of money the chief priest must have given them. These are professional soldiers. Tell people you got beat up by fishermen. You got fishermen snuck by you. Okay. Sure. That's going to cost you. But the story itself, an angel coming down, rolling the rock away, Jesus coming back from the dead, it just seems like it's a bit of a stretch. It seems like it's a bit of a tall tale, which brings me to my second question. Do you ever question the story? You're reading through the resurrection story, you're reading about how Jesus came back to life, you ever been like, really? There's no judgment. There's no, like, criticism if you've asked that question. You're not the first person to question the resurrection, and you won't be the last. Lots of people throughout the course of history have been like, really? He came back from the dead? He came back to life? Seriously? But I encourage you, if you've never questioned it, if you've never looked into it, I'm a big believer that we as Christians and as men and women doing our due diligence, we need to ask these questions. Did it really happen? Is what the Bible is telling me really true? And is there sources outside the Bible that I can check to make sure? Because when we ask those questions, it's not a sign of weakness. And if you've ever been told that doubt and questioning is a sign of weakness in your faith, I'm sorry. That's not true. That's not true at all. In fact, I would go the other way. I would invite questions. If things don't make sense, or you're like, does this really happen? Is there something that I can read or some backup that I can follow up to just double check some of this stuff? Come ask. I will find you sources. I will find you answers. And if I don't have the answers, I will look for them. And I won't embarrass anyone for wanting to know more, because questions isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign of wanting to grow stronger. It just solidifies what you already know. But we're going to go really quick to see, you know, how legitimate is this thing. So far, as far as people actually seeing Jesus alive, resurrected, walking around, we're at two. We're going to keep a running total of how many people, according to the Gospels, have seen Jesus alive. So right now, we got two women have seen him alive. We read in Luke that there's two disciples walking along, and the names of these men doesn't appear in the original 12, so it's probably not one of the 12. He's probably one of the bigger group. They're walking and discussing everything, and Jesus comes along and starts talking to them, starts revealing the truth of what they have experienced, and they sit down for a meal, and they realize that this is the resurrected Christ. And as they come to the realization, Jesus disappears. So now we're at four people have seen Jesus alive. John then tells us that the disciples are gathered. Of course, there's only 11 of them at this time. Judas has been so overcome by grief that he has taken his own life. He's not able to see the resurrected Christ. And we also find out, according to John, that Thomas isn't there. So there's 10 guys in this room, locked the door because they're scared of the chief priest. They're scared of the consequences of what has just happened. And Jesus appears among them. Now we're up to 14 people. 14 people have seen Jesus alive. Alive and well. And then I want to read the story of Thomas, because Thomas's account is very interesting. John is very intentional to list a very important detail about what happens with Thomas. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Okay, he's not missing out this time. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. And put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus said, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and have yet believed." I think this is where that whole questioning things is a sign of weakness, because Jesus says this to Thomas. But Thomas also had the advantage of spending 3 years with Jesus and knowing that Jesus only spoke the truth. But the important thing about this encounter between Jesus and Thomas is that Jesus still has the scars. Right? You can fake a resurrection. You can find a lookalike and cut the hair right. You put the right clothes on. You can walk them around, kind of keep people at a distance so they can't get too close to see that it's a fake. You can't fake holes in the wrists. You can't fake holes in the side. And remember with the why the hole in the side is significant is when Jesus was on the cross and he died and they had to remove the bodies and the prisoners were still alive, they were going to break the legs of the three prisoners. So the two criminals crucified with Christ, still alive, break their legs. Jesus, however, is dead, and the Roman guard sees it, and one of the prophecies of Jesus is that he will not have any of his bones broken. And so instead of breaking Jesus' legs, they take a spear, and they ram it through the side, and it says the blood and water came out, sure sign that Jesus surely had passed away, but not a bone was broken. And so there's the scar. Actually, it doesn't say there's a scar. It says there's a hole. There's still a hole there from where the spear went in. There's still holes in the hands. That's hard to fake. Anybody who's anybody would know that Jesus had been crucified, and those holes in the wrists, doctors all agree that it probably was the wrist, not the hand. The hand probably wouldn't have supported it. It's a sure sign that this really was the man that he was claiming to be. The problem is that when you take account, so we're at 15 people, but people don't like the 15 that have seen him. So 11 of them are disciples, so they could lie. Sure, they've seen Jesus, whatever. In the day, for two women to be the witnesses wouldn't have held any weight because women didn't have rights. They didn't have a voice in that day. So those two witnesses are out of question. And the guys on the road didn't recognize Jesus till the meal at night when it was dark. So they could have mistaken it for somebody else. So now all 15 of our witnesses don't count. Which is why what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 is really significant. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. And then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he also appeared to me. Of course, Paul at the time was persecuting everyone who claimed to be a follower of Jesus, and so for him to say, yeah, I saw Jesus, and he was very much alive, is very significant. 500 people saw Jesus alive. 500 people recognized him and saw the scars and knew that Jesus had once again been walking. You could discredit the 11 because they're loyal to Jesus and they want to, you know, look out for him. You could discredit the women because of the time and the lack of rights they had back then. You could discredit the other guys, but good luck discrediting the overwhelming cloud of witnesses that now was walking the earth saying that I have seen the risen Christ. I have seen Jesus. He is very much alive. He very much has scars in all the right places. And why all that? Why that is all set up. That's all opener, okay? Now we're going to get to the point. The reason Jesus resurrecting, coming back from the dead is so significant is because on Friday we look at the fact that Jesus would have done anything for you to be forgiven. He would have done anything for your sin to be taken away, for this curse of death and destruction that is hanging over every single person. He would have done anything, including enduring the most brutal death humanity has ever cooked up. He would have done it all. God loved you so much that he didn't even withhold his own son to save you. But not only is Jesus willing to do whatever it took to see you saved, he is going to overcome every obstacle, every challenge, everything to make sure that you stay saved. And he wasn't, not even death could hold back Jesus. Not even death could hold our Savior down. Jesus conquers everything, conquers every sin, every lie, every pressure, every bad thing going on that tries to keep us. Jesus overcomes it all, including death itself. And that is good news, because no matter where we are, no matter what you're going through, no matter what happens, what's bogging you down, what's holding you back, Jesus has overcome it all. Jesus has overcome. He's conquered everything. That nothing in all of creation, not height, nor depth, nor angels, nor demons, nor principalities or powers, nothing in all of creation could separate you from the love of Jesus, the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. And that is the most excellent news of Resurrection Sunday. That is why it is so important that we know that the resurrection is true, because if it is true, it has eternal consequence for each and every one of us. It reminds us that death is not the end, that there is eternity waiting for us. Eternity waits for everybody. The question is, is eternity going to be spent at God's right side, which Jesus died and resurrected to ensure, or are we spend eternity separated from God? Those are the only two options. There is no third option to just staying dead. You will spend eternity somewhere. The question is, where are you spending eternity? Where is your hope? Where have you got your eyes set? Because Jesus was willing to do anything he needed to do, and he overcame absolutely anything that stood between you and your Heavenly Father, who loves you so much.